Chapter 8. Robert Maxwell. The Bouncing Check. Robert Maxwell was not always Robert Maxwell. Born Abraham Lieb Hock on June 10, 1923, in the Czech village of Slatinsky Doli. His name was changed to Jan Abraham Ludwig to make it sound less Jewish on the birth register. It was the first of several name changes in his life before he finally settled on the very British-sounding Ian Robert Maxwell. His mother Hannah was a survivor of anti-Jewish pogroms in Poland. Her family had fled until they settled in what would later become Czechoslovakia. His father, Mikel, was also an immigrant Jew, whose family had traded cattle and horses for the few generations they had lived in Slatinsky Doli, after arriving from some unknown origin in the East. Maxwell inherited his physique from his father, who was tall and broad shoulders, and his mind from his mother. Hannah was a quick-witted woman, with a passion for social justice, and a Palestinian home for the Jews. Maxwell would later say she had intended for him to be a rabbi who would take the family to Palestine where they could live in the dignity denied them in Slatinsky Doli. Life was indeed harsh in the village. Winters were severe, and two of Maxwell's siblings died of pneumonia in childhood. The rest shared a single bed, ate a staple of potatoes with an occasional piece of smoked fish, and shared a single pair of shoes, which they stuffed with paper to adjust the size. It was no place for someone with Maxwell's burning ambition. As he grew, his mother encouraged him to move away to avoid the cloying poverty and the growing anti-Semitism that was emanating from Nazi Germany. In 1939, Hitler annexed Czechoslovakia. Maxwell, aged 16, left his village and family behind and joined the Czech army. He later claimed to have fought the Nazis in Eastern Europe, retreating to the Black Sea and finally making his way to southern France via Bulgaria and Greece. In Marseille, he joined the 2nd Regiment of the Czech Legion and sailed with them to Liverpool. Stationed just outside Dover, the man, now calling himself Jan Hock, and speaking almost no English, requested to join the British Army. He was transferred to the Pioneer Corps, stationed near Birmingham, where in his downtime he began to learn the English language and the finer points of English etiquette from a local woman who he may also have been having an affair with. By 1943, he had adopted the speech and mannerisms of an English gentleman. He applied for a post with the North Staffordshire Regiment and was enlisted in its 17th Infantry Brigade under the new name of Leslie Du Maurier, the moniker inspired by the popular brand of Du Maurier cigarettes. In 1944, he joined the war as part of the second wave to storm the Normandy beaches on D-Day. In France, Maxwell fought with distinction, receiving the Military Cross for bravery under fire and receiving a commission as an officer. He also changed his name again to Leslie Jones and finally to Ian Robert Maxwell on the advice of his commanding officer, who said the name sounded more fitting for an officer in the staffs. France was also the place where Maxwell met his future wife. A French Protestant from a middle-class background, Elizabeth Maynard first met Maxwell in the newly liberated Paris of 1944. Working in the offices of the Paris Welcome Committee, she was supposed to introduce him to Parisians who wanted to meet and entertain Allied servicemen. At the sight of the big charismatic man in his officer's uniform, Betty found herself becoming faint. Maxwell, playing the part of the dashing officer, caught her in his arms. It was love at first sight. In just a few months, the couple were married, a marriage that was to last more than 50 years, not all of them as happy as the first. When the war was over, Maxwell continued his military service in Berlin, where, as an intelligence officer, he was responsible for interrogating high-ranking Nazi officials. It was a time when the political map of Europe was being redrawn. New ties were being forged, and new partnerships formed, and much of it was happening in Berlin. Maxwell met a lot of interesting and important people, particularly from the intelligence and business worlds. It was through one of these contacts that Maxwell's long career in publishing began. He started working with Ferdinand Springer, a German publisher of scientific books, and became the British and US distributor for his company, Springer Verlag. In 1951, Maxwell merged the German publisher with a British rival, Butterworth Press, and renamed it Pergamon Press. It was the first in a long line of publishing and media companies that Maxwell would have a hand in. Back in the UK, Maxwell was not content just as a businessman. He began a political career and, following his mother's socialist leanings, became a Labour Party candidate in 1959. In 1964, he won a seat as Labour MP for Buckingham, which he kept until 1970. In the meantime, he continued to consolidate a corporate power base and build his ties with the intelligence world. Maxwell's post-war scientific publishing empire had extended from Germany and Britain into Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc. He had built ties with the KGB, and at some point he had begun working for Israel's most famous, or infamous, intelligence agency, Mossad. Although throughout his life Maxwell would be linked to the intelligence services of Britain, the Soviet bloc, and Israel, it was to the latter that his true and ultimate loyalty would be bound. He would never forget the religion or culture of his family upbringing, and he described Jerusalem as the only place he was ever truly happy. Nor would he forget the ultimate fate of his family, the mother, father, and siblings he had left behind in Slutinsky Dolly, most of whom had been killed during the Nazi occupation. Perhaps this was one of the reasons Maxwell used his ties with the KGB to help arrange the transit of Soviet Jews to Israel, a task which, according to Maxwell biographers Gordon Thomas and Matt Dillon, earned him the reputation of a modern-day Moses. According to Thomas and Dillon's book, Robert Maxwell, Israel's Super Spy, he also laundered money and bought and sold arms for Israel, and he used his scientific publishing interests to sell technological secrets to the burgeoning state. But it would be through a piece of computer software that Maxwell would make his biggest and most successful contribution to Israeli intelligence. PROMISE was a program developed by US intelligence services and was, at the time, being used by the US Department of Justice to track criminals. The software was capable of tracing the movements of vast numbers of people and, as such, could be invaluable for the purposes of spying. Israeli intelligence had covertly obtained a copy of the software, redesigned it, and fitted it with a trap door. This meant it could be sold on to foreign governments and organizations, who would unwittingly be sending all the information back to Israel. In order to market and sell the bugged software without the fingerprints of Israel's spy agencies, a cover organization was needed. A corporation with global reach and international influence. Israel turned to Maxwell, who marketed the software through his computer company, Dagom. In 1984, Maxwell, who was still celebrating his acquisition of Mirror Group newspapers, went to work on the project and quickly secured the first customers for PROMISE: Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, South Africa's apartheid regime, quickly followed, along with Guatemala, Colombia, and Nicaragua. All of these regimes used the software to round up, incarcerate, or disappear thousands of political dissidents. Maxwell even installed the software in the shadowy world of Swiss banking, selling the product to Credit Suisse, This enabled the security services to identify Israeli millionaires who had illegally opened overseas accounts. It also led them to secret money laundering operations by the CIA and the American Mafia, who were rinsing up to £300 million a day through Credit Suisse. The software gave Israel the numbers of every one of these top-secret accounts. Promise, either through Dagom or the US's own version, went on to serve many of the prime intelligence agencies in the world, including those of France, Germany, the UK, the Netherlands, and even China. Maxwell alone would make £500 million from the sales of the software, all while providing a steady stream of information back to the Mossad. But perhaps the tycoon's greatest coup was to sell the software to Sandia National Laboratories, the home of the US's ongoing nuclear weapons research program. Maxwell secured the deal via a Republican senator, John Tower, who was a powerful voice in Washington and a close ally of then-Vice President George H.W. Bush. Tower, who was being paid by Maxwell using Mossad funds, effected an introduction to the Sandia officials, and Maxwell completed the sale. It was an intelligence coup of staggering proportions, one that would enable Israel to steal nuclear secrets from the world's foremost nuclear weapons research lab and stay one step ahead of its competitors in the arms race. It wasn't only the clandestine nuclear weapons operation that Maxwell was part of. In September 1986, he received a worrying call from his foreign editor at the Mirror, and by many accounts, fellow Israeli spy, Nick Davies. Davies had been approached by a Colombian-born journalist from Australia called Oscar Guerrero, claiming he had proof that Israel was manufacturing nuclear weapons. Guerrero had made friends with an Israeli citizen travelling in Australia who claimed to have worked at a top-secret Israeli base in the Negev Desert, where nuclear devices were being developed. This whistleblower, Mordecai Vanunu, was said to have photographic proof of his claims and was thought to be in hiding in London, where he was selling his story to the Sunday Times. Maxwell immediately called Nahum Admoni, Director General of Mossad, with the news. The well-oiled gears of the intelligence agency went immediately into action, and Maxwell's Sunday Mirror published a story ridiculing Guerrero and Vanunu's claims. In the meantime, Israeli agents were scouring every hotel in London for the whereabouts of Vanunu. Towards the end of September, they finally located him, and an elaborate honey trap was set up to capture the traitor. A beautiful female approached Vanunu in Leicester Square and got chatting to him. The woman, posing as an American called Cindy, was actually a Mossad agent called Cheryl Bentov. Bentov seduced Vanunu and persuaded him to accompany her on a trip to Rome. The spy flew with Vanunu to the Italian capital and accompanied him to an apartment where three more Mossad agents were waiting. They overpowered Vanunu and injected him with a paralyzing drug. Later, they escorted him in an ambulance out of the city and down to the coast, where a speedboat was waiting. The speedboat rendezvoused with a freighter off the coast, and 3 days later, Vanunu was in Israel, where he was to spend the next 18 years in solitary confinement. Maxwell's part in the affair had been brief, but crucial. It was another in a growing list of services to his spiritual homeland. For every idealistic motive, Maxwell seemed to have a baser counterpart. Through his KGB connections, he had long been laundering money through the Bank of Bulgaria. In the late 80s, with the onset of Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika and the loosening of the Iron Curtain, Maxwell saw an opportunity to make lots of money through the impoverished Eastern European country. Maxwell made a deal with Bulgaria's president, Todor Zhivkov, to help fund and oversee the wholesale theft of technology from Western companies and its resale in the Soviet bloc. To accomplish this, Maxwell was effectively given the keys to Bulgaria's secret service to help run the operation. Not only did the scheme, dubbed NEVA, go on to succeed, stealing technological secrets from every major Western nation and reselling them in the East, but it led to the creation of perhaps the world's first globalized criminal network. Through the Russian and Bulgarian contacts Maxwell made via NEVA, he began to construct the criminal web that would encompass US Mafia, South American drug cartels, the triads, the Yakuza, and the Russian Mafia. This criminal octopus traded in prostitution, money laundering, drug trafficking, pornography, contract killings, and human trafficking of every kind. It was a global criminal syndicate worth billions, and it all transpired under the umbrella of an intricate web of shell companies that Maxwell had set up. It had made Maxwell what one FBI executive called the man who set in motion a true coalition of global criminals. Yet it still didn't seem to satisfy Maxwell's insatiable greed, nor, incredibly, did it provide him with financial security. Despite the huge money laundering operations and increasingly seedy business deals, Maxwell was edging closer and closer to the brink of financial ruin. His acquisitive nature was beginning to get the better of him, and he couldn't keep up with the interest on loans that had financed the buying of his latest assets, such as the publishing company Macmillan. On top of this, falling share prices in his above-board companies like Mirror Group Newspapers, MGN, and Maxwell Communications Corporation, MCC, had led him to increasingly desperate measures. Maxwell had been secretly buying shares in his own companies to prop up their prices. To accelerate the downward spiral, this money was being drawn from funds which were already being used as collateral for other bank loans. When his financial situation became desperate, Maxwell did the previously unthinkable. He began to plunder the pension fund of his employees at MGN. It didn't stop the rot. By the time his bank repayments had reached £415 million a year, Maxwell was resorting to ever more desperate measures. He persuaded his bankers at Goldman Sachs to buy shares in MCC to boost market confidence, saying he would then buy them back. The problem was, he needed to borrow the money to do so from other banks. To break the vicious cycle, he resorted to serious fraud, fictitiously claiming he had sold two of his companies for £120 million in order to set the share prices rising. It worked for a while, but by now, it was just postponing the inevitable. His personal life was also falling apart. His marriage to Betty had long been a sham. His affairs had started early. His first serious one, lasting several years, had been in 1974. But by now, they numbered perhaps in the dozens. He had usually kept his assignations in the penthouse suite at Maxwell House, or on his superyacht, the Lady Ghislaine. But by now, he was even bringing them back to the family house at Headington Hill Hall, where they masqueraded as personal assistants or secretaries. Whenever he arrived in Bulgaria or Israel on a business trip, he expected to have one of his favourite prostitutes waiting at the hotel room. Aside from the physical cheating, he had become emotionally distant from Betty, sharing none of his thoughts or concerns, indeed hardly seeing or speaking to her at all. His visits home were increasingly fleeting, and his manner cold. The inevitable came shortly after her 70th birthday. Maxwell said he wanted a divorce. When Betty presented him with her list of financial settlements, he agreed to only one. 8 days a year, aboard the Lady Ghislaine. Maxwell's increasingly rogue financial activities hadn't escaped his Israeli backers. The new Director General of the Mossad, Shabitai Shavit, was openly distrustful of the supposed super spy, Maxwell's increasing financial indiscretions and his involvement in organized crime were beginning to make him more of a liability than an asset. Perhaps sensing this, Maxwell was beginning to become paranoid for his safety. He hired the services of Jules Krall, one of the world's most accomplished private detectives, to investigate what Maxwell called his business enemies, who he thought were conspiring to destroy him. His personal behavior became more erratic, cancelling engagements, switching travel plans at the last moment, and spending hours alone listening to tapes of his employees' conversations at Maxwell House, which he'd had bugged. His paranoia was not necessarily irrational. A fellow Israeli spy and close friend, Amiram Nir, who had been embroiled in the Iran-Contra scandal, had recently met with a mysterious end in a plane crash over Mexico. When John Tower, Maxwell's backdoor into the White House, was also killed in a plane crash, Maxwell's obsessive tendencies went through the roof. In the meantime, he was fending off groups of enraged bankers left, right and centre, repaying loans with other loans, and using shares as collateral that had already been promised elsewhere. Somehow, he managed to keep all the plates spinning. Just. But in his desperation, he began to pester the Mossad for financial help. It may have been the last straw. Maxwell had recently been outed as an Israeli spy in Seymour Hersh's book, The Samson Operation, about Israel's nuclear program. Coupled with this unwanted publicity was Maxwell's increasingly worrying involvement in Russian politics. The tycoon had suggested holding a meeting between KGB head Vladimir Kurikov and Mossad chiefs over engineering a possible coup in Moscow in exchange for the transportation to Israel of Russian Jews. The suggestion of getting Israel directly involved in an attempted overthrow of a superpower regime must have only confirmed the Mossad's appraisal of Maxwell, that he had lost his judgment and become a liability. In November 1991, everything came to a head. On November 4, Maxwell had missed a meeting with the Bank of England about his default on £50 million worth of unpaid loans. On the following day, he was reported missing in the seas of the Atlantic, just off the Canary Islands, where he had been cruising aboard the Lady Ghislaine. Later that day, his body was found. The autopsy uncovered no injuries, and an inquest ruled death by accidental drowning caused probably by a heart attack. Suicide could not be ruled out. Maxwell clearly had a lot on his plate, and it was beginning to catch up with him. But Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine, would claim something very different. She said her father had been murdered. Two former Israeli intelligence officers, Victor Ostrovsky and Ari Ben-Menashe, agreed with this conclusion. Ben-Menashe described how a Mossad hit team had drawn up alongside the Lady Ghislaine in the early hours of the morning, boarded the boat using rubber grappling hooks, and injected Maxwell in the back of the neck with a lethal nerve agent, before dumping his body over the side and making their escape. Maxwell, according to Ben-Menashe, had finally become too much of a liability. The possibility of his arrest and trial for financial crimes could spell the leakage of some very uncomfortable state secrets. Maxwell was always a wild card, but he had, in the end, become too unpredictable. He simply had to go. Israel had always been Maxwell's spiritual home, and it was there that he found his final resting place. His funeral was a lavish state affair, conducted on the Mount of Olives, where he was buried amongst the heroes and statesmen of the modern state of Israel. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, President Chaim Herzog, and no fewer than six serving and former heads of Israeli intelligence attended the ceremony. The glowing testimonials to one of the world's most powerful businessmen were soon followed by the fallout from his collapsing empire. Banks from around the world were frantically calling in loans. Maxwell's sons, Kevin and Ian, desperately tried to hold the sinking ship together, but it was too far gone. They were declared bankrupt with debts of £400 million. Maxwell's theft of his Mirror Group pension funds soon came to light. And in 1996, Kevin, Ian, and two other former directors went on trial for conspiracy to defraud. They were all acquitted. The pension funds were partially replenished by the British taxpayer. However, the company's employees ultimately only received half of what they were due. Maxwell's legacy was ultimately one of lies and deceit, characterised in the British media as Cap'n Bob and the bouncing check. He had become something of a joke. However, the legacy he left, the State of Israel, was something altogether different. Thousands of Soviet Jews repatriated. Millions, perhaps billions of dollars laundered and stored through his banking networks. The sale of bugged promise software to some of the most powerful countries in the world, and a major hand in the theft of US nuclear secrets. Liar, fraudster, bully, philanderer, criminal, cheat. Whatever else he had done, Maxwell was an unswervingly loyal servant to his spiritual homeland. And then, of course, there was the protege he left to the world, Jeffrey Epstein.